Today we start with three stories.
Story number one. Now, if you look at the yearbooks from my elementary school, you'll see pictures of an art teacher named Mrs. Gora. Now, Mrs. Gora always dressed in costume on picture day. Photos show her dressed as a witch, an alien, and even a Star Wars stormtrooper. Now, in real life, Mrs. Gora wore thick lens glasses and bizarre voluminous outfits, and she passed out petrified candy bars and broken toys as rewards for art well done. It's no wonder, then, that when I drew an unimaginative tree, she said, "Ordinary stinks. Stand up and be who you are. Don't be dull. Lift it, kiddo." Now, once I left Mrs. Gora behind and began middle school, we were encouraged to decorate. Remember those old brown paper textbook covers? You'd make those out of, I don't know if you kids do that nowadays, but we did that back then. We'd make them out of grocery sacks and so on. But I heard her "lift it, kiddo" in my head. And so I decorated the brown grocery sack paper of my math book cover with swirls of red and yellow paint that reminded me of a field of Van Gogh flowers. Well, I carried that book to school the next day, and immediately the tongues began to wag. "Are those flowers on his book? Doesn't he know he's a boy?" By fourth period, Carl Breck was elected to approach me. "Boys don't have flowers on their book covers," he said, not meeting my eyes. "Why?" I asked, thinking about Mrs. Gora, who would have asked the very same question. He paused, stumped. "They just don't," he said, and then ran away. Determined to challenge the status quo, I made my way through two more classes before the name-calling got to be too much. I tore my masterpiece from the book and threw it in the garbage can. The moral of this story? Flowers can be dangerous. Story number two. In 1809, a dozen French troops stopped to rest and eat in the woods outside of Madrid. Using branches cut from a tree, they removed the beautiful pink flowers and made skewers to roast meat on. After eating, they began to feel nauseous, which was quickly followed by vomiting. The sickness worsened until 7 of the 12 men died simply because their food had come into contact with wood, with what turned out to be from the beautiful but poisonous oleander. If you even eat honey made by bees that have gathered pollen from oleander flowers, you'll probably die. Moral of this story? Flowers can be dangerous. So story number three. In the musical Little Shop of Horrors... You know where I'm going with this, right? Seymour, yeah, I mean, that's it. I'm not going to sing it for you, but the flower eventually orders Seymour to feed me, and he begins committing murder to feed his hungry flower. So the moral of the story, say it with me, flowers can be dangerous. Now look, I know a lot of you came today because you love the Flower Communion service, and rightly so. It's a Unitarian Universalist tradition, and here I am ruining it with my stories of bloodthirsty or poisonous flowers, but I promise there is a point to all of this. And to get to that point, I will take you now back in time to Prague, 1923, to a large church sanctuary where a man named Norbert Chopik will speak to you about a dilemma he faces. And I have a warning. Norbert Chopik may bear some slight resemblance to me. This transformation may astound you, though.
"Ah, you have come, my friends. Forgive my dour expression. My wife always says that I wear my feelings, my inner feelings, like a child. But even though I am 52 years old now, I'm glad no one from my own congregation is here, because, you see, they are my problem, but don't tell them." No. Now, some of these people from my congregation, they come from a Jewish background, some Catholic, some Christian, but these different people have all chosen to worship together in this church home, one that is progressive and open. But an open faith, no, that has not always been mine. No, I grew up a Roman Catholic.
But Catholicism was not right for me, so I found the Baptist, and that seemed right for a while. Of course, I was 18 years old, and at 18, a lot of things seem right that don't seem right later on, you know? But there was a need always within me to serve others. So I set out with a stack of Bibles under my arm and an eagerness to spread this message of love and salvation. And it worked, too. Maybe they felt sorry for a boy with bright eyes and dusty clothes, but at farmhouses and cottages, I found eager ears ready to hear good news as doors opened to me. But along the way, an unexpected door opened within me. The more I traveled, the more I spoke with different people of different faiths, the more questions stirred within me. I eventually found myself in charge of many Baptist churches, but I couldn't stop questioning my idea of faith opening up like a flower. So I was ordered to stand before the angry members of the Baptist Church Council. One of them said, "You talk like a heretic." Another said, "You fill your congregation's head with ideas that make them question everything." As if that's bad, you know? And finally, one said, "You talk like a Unitarian. Why don't you go join them?" Now, he had meant to insult me, yes, but no. I had even then been a Unitarian. I just did not know it yet. And now, several years later, I stand here in my own Unitarian congregation, minister to a congregation of thousands, and wondering, how do I bring them all together? We've thrown out dogma and mindless ritual and stimulated the congregants intellectually, but how do I get beyond the rumblings that there is something spiritual missing? There is need to feed their souls with a binding ritual, something like that of the traditional bread and wine communion service. Yes, but no, that will not do. It will have to be something new that reflects that we have all chosen this inclusive faith. But what to do? Look at the light streaming in through the windows. Instead of wrestling with this problem, I wish I were out there. You know, when the flowers are in bloom on those hills, you have never seen such a glorious sight. Perhaps that is my answer, no? I could bring the joy of creation inside these walls. So simple. But perhaps that is it. And so with some artistic license, that's the story of how the flower communion was born. So picture that first ceremony, a hushed church building beginning to fill with smiling people, eyes wide as they take in the visual feast held in each other's hands. Red corn poppies picked from a nearby field, purple Siberian irises, floral perfume in the air. They walk down the aisle and place their offerings into a giant vase resting on the center table. Words aren't necessary to explain to them that this symbolizes their willingness to join together in community. Words aren't necessary because they feel it. After Norbert Chopik blesses the vase of flowers, the church members approach the bouquet and they take a flower from it. But this time, it's one someone else has brought as a testament to their commitment to joining forces in doing good in this world, no matter what their differences. That's a lovely metaphor, isn't it? Nothing dangerous in that, right? We're talking about people feeding their souls, not man-eating flowers or oleanders transmitting a poison or even art teachers and schoolboys committing violations of floral gender norms. There isn't anything about a flower communion service that would scare men who carry guns, right? Unfortunately, there was plenty there to scare them. In 1941, frightened by the popularity of Chopik's liberal church and seeing its emphasis on unity within diversity as the antithesis of Nazi politics, the SS arrives at Chopik's door. Chopik is convicted of treason and sent to Dachau concentration camp. Now, when I first heard this story, however many years ago, after stepping foot in a UU church, I couldn't help but wonder, when he was cold, hungry, in Dachau, Did the message of his church still resonate with him? Did this flower communion, with its celebration of community, seem trite amongst the stark realities of tortured prisoners? Did Chopik hold on to his faith when he awoke to find dozens of priests hanging by chains in the air? Could Chopik have even held on to his humanity, much less his faith, during those dark times? Not the first time I've wondered such things. When I was 3 years old, we lived across the street from the Schneiders. The Schneiders were a cheerful couple who spoke English with a noticeable accent. They kept neat flower beds in front of their red brick house, a house that would have been ordinary but for the children. There were children leaning out of the windows of this house trying to catch lightning bugs to put them in butter dishes with holes cut in the lids. We did that back in the Midwest. Children racing Hot Wheels cars down the hallways inside the house, and children sending Barbie dolls to watery graves in the bathroom sink. So the Schneiders ran a daycare out of their home. That's what they did. And it wasn't long before I was one of the kids that they cared for. For lunch, the bulky Mr. Schneider would strap a ruffled apron to his figure and make dozens of silver dollar pancakes for us and sing old German songs. Mrs. Schneider always had multiple babies in tow and seemed able to change a diaper, break up a scuffle, and answer the phone all at once. And this was in the days when phones had cords. No. They were good, dependable people, not perfect. Occasionally, Mr. Schneider yelled at the most intractable children, usually in German, which made it sound worse because we had no idea what he was saying. But they were always kind. I remember one day watching as Mrs. Schneider sat down to do some embroidery. She rolled up her sleeves, and for the first time I noticed the numbers tattooed on her arm. Later, I noticed ones on her husband's as well. It took me a few years before I really knew what that meant. And then I'd wonder how they'd survived, how they'd gone on after. How do they wipe all those little noses and make endless stacks of silver dollar pancakes? How does anyone go on? That's what they did. You know, they weren't superheroes or people the history books will remember in particular, but they went on. And I learned then that people of ideals and principles can see the worst side of humanity and still emerge determined to make a difference. I now see the beauty in the Schneiders caring for so many children, tending those small human buds that promise to blossom into beautiful flowers. So with that understanding of resiliency, Norbert Chopik's commitment to Unitarian ideals, even behind the walls of Dachau, stayed strong. Who knew that's possible? But it is. The 70-year-old man, eyes still bright despite the abuses of that place, now actually composed inspirational songs for the other prisoners to sing at the top of their lungs as they marched around the barbed wire enclosure. Many prisoners came out of there saying that they would have given up all hope had it not been for him. I wonder how anybody can be that strong, and I'm humbled that Norbert Chopik's faith is the faith I have chosen. And I think of the Schneiders and Mrs. Gora, and I look out at all of you and think of all of us in this together. And I think that maybe in that togetherness we can find that strength. So the Nazis didn't let Chopik's influence go on for too long. Eventually, they moved him to the medical experimentation section of the camp. Even there, he wrote one final prayer. It is worthwhile to live and fight courageously for sacred ideals. Oh, blow ye evil winds into my body's fire. My soul you'll never unravel. He was eventually put to death in the gas chamber, giving those words, oh, blow ye evil winds into my body's fire, another layer of meaning. Nazi court records show that it was too dangerous to the Reich for him to be allowed to live. Now, here's a sentence I never thought I'd say. I think they were right. I think he was dangerous. His flowers and their message of the power of community was dangerous to their ideology. Even today, we who follow in his footsteps are dangerous to those who would stop us because Our souls tell us, feed us, and we listen and do. We are dangerous because, like the oleander, we affect everything that we touch, but it isn't poison we spread, but the spirit of life itself. We are dangerous because, like Mrs. Gora and the sixth grade boy she inspired to wear flowers on his book jacket in defiance, we wear our principles out where the sun shines on them. We are dangerous because, like the Schneiders, we have witnessed terrible things, but we will continue to choose hope, to nurture the children of this world, to create a brighter future. We are dangerous. When you take your flower today, allow yourself absolutely to appreciate its beauty and the hope and community it represents, but don't forget the danger attached to each and every one of those flowers. Embrace it. Let it remind you that we have a message that 70-some years after Chopik's death is still a radical one. Wear that radical message boldly, like a peony or a daffodil wears its vibrant scarlet or yellow petals. Don't settle for the status quo. Lift it, kiddo, and make that flower proud. And so, it is now time for our flower communion, and I will invite Eleanor to be the first person to select a flower from up here to take with her, one that you did not bring yourself, one that represents someone else's gift to this community. Please hold the vase as you select a flower. Some of them are lightweight and will fall over, but thank you. And I hope that as you take that flower home with you today, it is a reminder to you of all the beautiful gifts and the diversity that is reflective of this wonderful community. So as the music begins, you are welcome to come forward and take a flower of your choosing.